All right, so we are studying Esther, and if you've been here from the beginning, you know that she is a very godly woman. She's an individual that all of us can learn from, both men and women. She has characteristics that as Christians we need and that we should emulate, of course, in our lives. But certainly a great example for women. That she is humble and submissive. When you think of Esther, you think of passages like 1 Peter chapter 3, and always impressed by what Peter says in this particular context. Very, very familiar. I'll just read it quickly and we'll get back to Esther. But Peter says, likewise, wives, be subject to your own husbands, so that even if some do not obey the word, they may be won without a word by the conduct of their wives when they see your respectful and pure conduct. Do not let your adoring be external. And right away, you begin to think about Esther. We realize, as we have studied in the first few chapters there, Esther, one of the most beautiful women in the world. But it was her inner beauty that was more impressive than anything else. So it says here, don't let your adorning be external, the braiding of hair, the putting on of gold jewelry, or the clothing you wear. But let your adorning be the hidden person of the heart, with the imperishable beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which in God's sight is very precious. For this is how the holy women who hoped in God used to adorn themselves, by submitting to their own husbands, as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord. And I'm always impressed with this passage when Peter, by inspiration, of course, brings up Sarah. Because when you, as you know, we studied Abraham, and then in doing that, we saw some things about Sarah. She was submissive to Abraham. And obviously, because Peter uses her, she had a meek and quiet spirit. But do any of you, when you go through Genesis and you read about Sarah, do you think she was just this frightened, timid woman? That's not really the impression you get of Sarah. And yet she was submissive enough to call Abraham Lord, and evidently had a meek and quiet spirit. Again, Peter uses her for an example of that. So that's the kind all women should strive to be. That's not an insult. It's not a put down. It doesn't mean anybody's inferior or anything like that, like the world would have you believe. It is something that is really important to God, and it impresses him, and that's the most important thing. And so going back over to Esther then, let's get back to her. She was that kind of woman. Now, we're at the point in our study then that all of the characters, the main characters of this real-life drama have now been revealed to us. You have Xerxes, the king, and Haman was introduced last week. And they're just kind of co-stars in the thing. But Esther and Mordecai are the main ones. And, of course, the real star is Esther. And the book is named after her. But we did start last week looking in chapter 3, looking at Haman. He's introduced. And as you think about some of the things we saw last week, going back at verse 1, after these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, and advanced him and set him on the throne above all of the officials. Now, we don't know exactly. Most would just refer to him as prime minister, something like he basically was in the position that Daniel was in when he was advanced and promoted. But when you think of those two individuals, they are complete opposites, aren't they? Daniel and Haman. But basically, whatever title that he had, he had a lot of authority, was right up there with the king. Now, most believe that he was promoted, and I don't want to use the word trickery, but certainly there was corruption involved, maybe bribery. He, as we see today, he was very wealthy, evidently. And that may have had something to do with the fact that he was promoted, the kind of guy who would betray friends or slander rivals or anything he could to get to the top. And it appears as if something like that was involved, because he certainly didn't deserve the position that he was now in. And one of the keys to that is, and I think we pointed this out last week, but in verse 2, all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. Now, there's absolutely no reason for the king to have to have done that. Like, that was just the way it was in Persia and in the East. At that particular time, everyone did that just naturally. To anyone, to the king certainly, but those who were just under the king, everybody would bow to them. It was just a matter of respect. And so the fact that the king had to command these people to do that says something, doesn't it? Yeah, I mean, there's at least one or two things going on here. Either the king, either Xerxes knew that he really wasn't respected, and so he better command, or he had been in the office now and the king realized people weren't giving him the respect he deserved, so he had to set forth the command. Either way, it shows the lack of leadership, the lack of respect that Haman hid. There was probably a lot of other officials who deserved to be promoted before him. But here he is, because he probably got there again through bribery or flattery or whatever. And now nobody wants to really give him respect until the king commands. And so, but once the king commanded, then of course everyone did what the king said, except for Mordecai. And so that's a key part in all of this. At verse 2, it goes on to say, for the king had so commanded concerning him, but Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage. And so now you got to ask yourself the question as you look at this, why? Why did Mordecai not bow? And what comes to your mind right at first is because, you know, he's not going to commit idolatry or... But that's not really what's going on here. Like, when these people bowed down to people in positions of authority, it wasn't idolatrous. They didn't do it like that. Now, sometimes they did in certain situations, and particularly as we get into the first century and with the emperors demanding to be worshipped and claimed to be deity and that sort of thing, they wanted to be worshipped, and you would have that sort of thing going on. But at this time, it was natural to bow down and pay homage to the king and other people who were in positions of authority, even people who were in low-level positions of authority, or just even when you were showing respect to someone. And so we see that in the Bible over and over again. Abraham bowed down to the Hittites when he was trying to arrange to buy the property for Sarah, who had died, you know, the burial place. And you go back and read that, he bowed down to them. And we I can give all kind of examples of that. David bowed down to Saul. And the Bible specifically said he bowed down, paid homage to him. David allowed other people, after Saul was killed, a fellow came who happened to be a Amalekite, and he bowed down to David, and David allowed him to do it. Whenever there was idolatry involved, the person, if he was a godly person, like there were some folks who tried to bow down and worship Paul and I think Barnabas, Paul and Barnabas, what did Paul tell them to do? Get up. Don't do that. We're men just like you. But in the case that I'm referring to, David, he allowed the person to do it. Didn't think anything of it because that was a normal thing to do. The brothers of Joseph's brothers in Egypt, what did they do when they appeared before him? They bowed down because he was an Egyptian authority. They didn't know it was Joseph, but he was in a position of power, and that's just what you do. By the way, the Joseph who we know was a godly man, if anybody was, did he tell him to get back up? No, he didn't scold them for doing that because it wasn't an idolatrous situation. It was just showing respect. And that's all that is going on with Haman. Now, some think that it is possible that Haman himself was demanding that people worship him. And that wouldn't have been a part of the decree that the king set forth, but he was kind of just doing that on his own. I couldn't prove that that wasn't the case. But, you know, there's no evidence in the text that that was the case. And so that brings up the issue then. If this was a normal way to react, why did Mordecai take such a strong stand and not do it? Now that leads to a lot of scholars, when you study through this, a lot of them will say that this was just an example of Mordecai being overcome with pride. And just, you know, being unreasonable, and that he should have and respected authority and done that. And there's not a few who come to that conclusion. Now, I'll say as an aside, well, first of all, let me just tell you, I don't believe that was the case with Mordecai. But, you know, it's not an unreasonable argument if you really don't know Mordecai. But Mordecai was just a man. One of the things that we have consistently said and seen in all of these different narratives that we have studied, whether it's Abraham or Moses or Joseph, they all had their faults and flaws, didn't they? And in fact, Mordecai and even Esther, they, you know, there are some things about them that are problematic that we just don't get into because in this narrative, it doesn't get into it. You know, the fact that nobody knew that they were Jews. You got to think about that. I mean, if you want to just think about the situation, if nobody knew that they were Jews, what weren't they doing? Huh? Yeah. I don't know about that, but I mean that's reasonable to conclude just that they weren't telling the truth. They probably never lied. They were probably never asked. It'd be like if I as a Christian went to work and or school or whatever, and nobody ever knew that I was a Christian. Well, it may not be a matter of me lying to them. I'm just not telling anybody. I don't want anybody to know that I'm a Christian. So I'm not going to tell. If they would ask me, I'd tell, yeah, I am. But nobody asked, I'm not going to tell. Well, if I had that attitude, what am I not doing? Right, I'm not evangelizing. I'm not telling anybody about Christ, am I? I'm not standing up for the Lord in any way. And so think about that with regard to Mordecai and Esther. Were they telling, here they are in a foreign land and plenty of opportunity to tell people about Yahweh and to how great he is. Are they doing any of that? Nope. Because nobody knows they're a Jew. And if they were, people would know. And like you think about Daniel in Babylon. Did people know that he was a Jew? Absolutely. And right at the beginning, we see he was taking a stand with regard to his Jewishness and his background. No, I'm not going to eat from the king's table. I don't want to be defiled. And of course, we know that he didn't want to be defiled before God. And he wasn't ashamed to let people know that. When he prayed, how did he pray? Yet right, window open, he wasn't. That's how he ended up getting thrown into the lion's den, because he wasn't ashamed of who he was. And so now, I've probably said enough about that, simply because all of that is a fact. I mean, it's something when you start thinking about the character of Mordecai and Esther. I mean, they were wonderful and full of faith. All of that, we'll see that more and more as we go through, but they weren't perfect. And there was a reason why they were had really gotten involved into the Persian environment and all of that. They fit right in, and nobody knew that they were Jews at all. If you wanted to push that, we could. But since the narrative doesn't, then we don't. I only bring all that up to say, when people say, well, yeah, Mordecai didn't bow down, that was a problem with his character. You know, that's not unreasonable, and it's not like, oh, Mordecai was perfect, so nobody should ever say that. I just think they're wrong in this case. But he wasn't a perfect man, just like none of us are. Yes?
I was going to say, I think we see one of Esther's flaws later on, too. Even though, of course, we talk about her good character, we often hear about her final response to Mordecai of, if I perish, I perish. But her first response to him is, I could die. Like, she's scared for her life. And granted, that's a natural response, but she's more concerned at first about her life than doing what's right. And
right.
I would say that that's definitely a flaw.
Yeah, I mean, and these are people. And we say that, and, I mean, you know, it's not being unreasonable. Fact is, we would probably all be more like her than not. All of us. But, you know, people aren't perfect. And neither are these individuals. But, again, getting back to the original thing with Mordecai, in my estimation, he didn't refuse to bow simply because of pride. He doesn't demonstrate throughout the story that he's that kind of individual. So to me, it'd be hard-pressed to say that. Even though he does have faults and flaws, he's not pictured like that. But remember, who was Haman? What was his background? Right. Agagite. So he is a part of the people who are the known enemies of God. And it seems to me, as we think about that, why wouldn't he bow down to him? It would be more along those lines. He knew he wouldn't be committing idolatry, but he would be taking sides with someone who was a part of the people who were enemies of God. Remember what James said? If you're a friend of the world, what are you? Enemy of God. You got to pick a side. And that was important to Mordecai. And it should have been. Saul, of course, who was a Benjaminite, just like Mordecai, he failed in that regard. And Mordecai's not going to do that. He has a problem with Amalekites. It's not an ethic, racist kind of situation. It is a situation where these are the enemies of God. And it was their fault. They started this whole thing. Remember, going all the way back, I think we looked at it last week or the week before when they ambushed the Israelites on their way out of Egypt. That started the whole problem. And so God swore and had it written that he was going to eliminate the Amalekites from the face of the earth. And he tried to do that through Saul, but what did Saul do? He spared the king. And obviously spared some others. He mostly did what God told him to do, but mostly obeying God is what? It's disobedience. And so now you have the Amalekites surviving, and here's one of them, and he's going to do everything he can to have the Jews exterminated. See? But Mordecai knows this is a Agagite. I'm not bound to him. No how, no way. He's an enemy of God. He didn't want to be like, you remember Joab said about David on one occasion, you love those who hate you and you hate those who love you. And he said that with regard to Absalom, what's his, huh? Yeah, say that. and Absalom. Yeah. And anyway, so he, you know, he was mourning and all of that. And Joab thought, you treat your enemies better than that. And so he didn't want to be like that. He didn't want to side with Mordecai. Now, he didn't want to side with anyone who was an enemy of God. That really is a good thing. And it should be the case with us as well. It wasn't it wasn't simply a personal grudge, nor should we have personal grudges. But should we make friends with the enemies of God? No. No, like I'm always amazed at how can you hang out with someone who is constantly using God's name in vain? How can you be around other people who openly hate your father? That didn't make a whole lot of sense. And yet sometimes we see people in the body of Christ doing that very thing. Well, Mordecai was making a stand in this struggle between God and the Amalekites. He was choosing God's side. And so that's why I think he was so adamant that he was not going to bow down to this individual. I don't think it's a negative thing at all. I think it's a good thing. All right. Well, so he doesn't do that. And that, of course, is going to get the ball rolling towards some trouble. It says, and when they spoke to him day after day, he would not listen to them. So they were trying. Doesn't seem like they have anything against him, but they were trying to figure out, why aren't you doing this? Like, this was a serious stand for Mordecai to take. Because at the end of the day, who was he disobeying? The king. And so really, he could have lost his life in this. And if Haman wasn't the kind of man he was, he probably would have lost his life on this occasion. But all the other ones, the officials were trying to get him to give an answer. You know, why aren't you trying to, it appears trying to talk him into paying homage to Haman, but he wouldn't listen. And so they told Haman in order to see whether Mordecai's words would stand. And what that's referring to, I skipped a verse there somewhere where he finally, as they're day after day saying, hey, why aren't you bowing? Why aren't you doing? Finally, he told them, I'm a Jew. And so now they want to go back and what I wonder, you know, is that going to stand? Is that going to fly with Haman? Is that going to get him out of this situation? And they probably wanted to know how they could get out of the situation. So is that going to work? And so they take it to Haman and see how he is going to respond to that. And of course, his response is belligerent. It says, and when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage to him, Haman was filled with fury. Now, just think about his arrogance there. Everybody's bowing down to him. And in the king's court, there would be all kinds of people there all the time. And every time the people first come in, you know, they wouldn't do it over and over. But every time someone came into his presence, they would bow down, pay homage to him. Everyone except for one man. He didn't even notice the one man wasn't doing it. And so he has all these people praising him, bowing down to him, doing all, and because one man won't do it, he's in a fury. That's pretty arrogant, don't you think? And that's just the kind of individual he was. But he was full of rage because of this. And watch what it says. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. What do you think would have happened to Mordecai if he acted like a normal person would? And he's mad, and he takes it to the king because the king is the one who set forth the command. He was violating the king's command, and that probably would have been a death sentence if Haman would have taken it to Xerxes and said, we have this fellow over here. He's disobeying you purposely, willfully, and he won't stop. What do you think Xerxes would have done? Anybody here think he wouldn't have put him to death? And so, I mean, that would have been the normal response. But Haman is so full of rage that once he learns he's a Jew, he sees an opening. I'm going to get rid of all of the Jews. And so that's what he sets up his mind to do. And says, so as they had made known to him the people of Mordecai, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. And now, that the whole kingdom, who would escape? What Jews would survive this situation? You're not just talking about right there in that area. Remember that kingdom, basically from Pakistan all the way to North Africa. That was the, if you can think of that whole broad area, that all the Jews in any part of that area would be put to death. That would mean all of them. So they would be exterminated. Genocide is what he is proposing here. And so now you, what kind of individual would do that? Because one man made him mad. I mean, when you think about, hey, it's, remember I told you last week that even today, Jews that on that feast of Purim, they, whenever his name is read, they read through the Esther, and whenever they hear his name, they shout and blow horns and stomp their feet and all of that. Why in the world do you think they do that? Later on, it will say in this text that he's an enemy of the Jews. That's exactly what he is. Because of one man made him, one man wouldn't bow. He decides in all good conscience, I'm going to wipe out all of them. Men, women, children, doesn't matter. We're going to kill them all. This is not a good man, obviously. And so, but that's what he has decided to do. Now, watch as he still has to get this by the king. Luckily for him, he's serving a weak-minded king. And so watch how he does it. It says at verse 6, but he disdained the laying on of hand. Go down further than, I'm sorry, verse 7. In the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of the king of Ahasuerus, they cast they cast lots before Haman day after day, and they cast it month after month, and until the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. Now I wrote in here that if you have the New King James Version, it reads they determined the day and the month. So that reads quite a bit differently there, but the New King James kind of makes more sense, really. Some have concluded they did this, you know, cast these lots for, you know, several months. That really doesn't make a whole lot of sense. They're just, all they're doing is trying to determine when they're going to pull this off and execute all the Jews. And so the King James, again, they did that to determine the day and the month. Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, there is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples and all the provinces of your kingdom. So now watch, as he goes before the king, he uses half-truths and just straight-out lies, but he knows he can manipulate this king. So this first thing that he says, there's a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. That wasn't true. That's highly unlikely that that was true. That there were Jews, I mean, this is a massive kingdom, remember, that there were Jews in every single province. Why would he exaggerate that like that? He wants Xerxes to really feel threatened. Like these guys, these people, they're everywhere. And they were scattered, but they weren't in every province. And then he says their laws are different from those of every other people. Well, yeah, there's some truth to that. Real truth to that, of course. They lived by God's law. And God's law was different. But there were a lot of things with regard to God's law that were practiced by a lot of people. Like, it wasn't that they were that different. There were some very specific things that were different. There's no doubt about that. But he's exaggerating the situation. And because he's trying to leave an impression on them. But then he gives a straight out lie. He says, and they do not keep the king's law. Is that true? That wasn't true. One man wouldn't bow down to him. And he says, here they are. Hey, Xerxes, we got a big problem. There's this foreign people, and there's a whole lot of them. They're everywhere. In every province, they're strange. They're different from everybody else, and they're willfully disobeying you. This is a real threat. They're dangerous. And now you think if you're the king, oh, yeah. Yeah, we need to get rid of them. But none of that was really true. They weren't dispersed everywhere. And they were different in some ways, but they were keeping. You remember Jeremiah, we read it a few weeks ago. Jeremiah, when they were first taken into captivity, Jeremiah gave them very specific instruction. You do what the law, whatever the situation is, you keep the law. As long as it doesn't conflict with God, you be a good citizen. And do what's favorable with regard to the people. Fit in, basically. That's what Jeremiah told the people. And they did that. So they weren't going around breaking all the laws all the time. That was just a lie. But he's trying to paint the picture for Xerxes and wants him to feel threatened. So, and then he closes it all with a little bribery. He said, if it please the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who have charge of the king's business, that they may put it into the king's treasury. And that was a whole lot of money. It's hard to determine exactly. I think Herodotus said that it was 2/3 of the kingdom's annual income. It would be, today, it would be millions, whatever it was. That's why we said earlier, it's probably the case, either one or two things. Haman was very, very wealthy. That may have been what landed him in this position of authority. But he probably was thinking, too, as they plundered the Jews, he would get a lot of money, too, and that would help pay and finance this situation. He basically telling the king, hey, let's do this, and I'll give you 10,000 the talents for this and put it in your treasury. So he's basically, he's trying to bribe him. And so the king, it says, and so the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, the enemies of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, the money is given to you, the people also, to do with them as it seems good to you. So basically he's saying, that this is, again, some of these verses that translated differently in different versions. Basically he's saying, you know, do what you want with the money, whatever. If you feel like you want to spend your money, your riches that way, fine. But the people are yours. You do what you want. And so Xerxes basically is giving him what he wants. You know what Haman didn't even do? What's missing here? He didn't even tell the king who the people were. Xerxes is blindly giving in to genocide. Say, yeah, go ahead and kill them all. You think a king with all the authority and say, just who are these people? No, none of that. Just, yeah. The money, do what you want. If that's how you want to spend your money, fine. The people are yours. And so what a weak king. Again, we see how weak he is in all of this. And I got to believe Haman knew going in, boy, if I stretch the truth just a little bit, lie just a little bit, and then offer him some money, I'll get the job done. I know how I can do this. And he was right. He was right. And so the king's scribes were summoned on the 13th day of the first month, and an edict according to all that Haman commanded was written to the king's satraps and to the governors over all the provinces to the officials of all the people, to every province in its own script and every people in its own language. It was written in the name of King Ahasuerus and sealed with the king's signet ring. Letters were sent by couriers to all of the king's provinces and instructions to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all Jews, young, old, women, children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. A copy of the document was to be issued as a decree to in every province by proclamation to all the people to be ready for that day. And so that's how it would all work out. The good thing and the providence of God that was involved in all of this was that these lots, when they were cast, it would be a year before they actually do it, just about a year before they would actually do it. And so that gave them the time they needed to escape all of this. Like, they would have been in trouble if those lots fell on tomorrow. And so, you know, 12 months. And so, and then what? And finally, verse 15, the couriers went out and hurried by the orders of the king. The decree was issued in Shusha, the citadel. Now watch. And the king and Haman sat down to drink. Now you just think about the character of these two men. They have just decided and decreed to commit genocide. A whole nation of people, men, women, young, old, children, everybody is going to die. And then they sit down and drink. Like Xerxes, he doesn't need much of an excuse to drink, does he? But he did. And watch. It said, but the city of Susa was thrown into confusion. Even the Persians, like, what is going on? What is this? It was so bizarre. But now, the fate of the Jews is hanging in the balance. And if the Jews go, what happens? Right? The Christ is coming through them. So this is serious business, and God's going to have to intervene to fix all of this, and he does. So we'll pick up chapter 4 next week.